Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hello there, and thank you for joining us. Well, last week, Whovies around the world travelled via their TV TARDIS through 50 years of Doctor Who. Last week also marked the 50th anniversary of the deaths of C.S. Lewis and Aldous Huxley, authors who used science fiction to ask some very big questions. Tonight, from Star Wars to Star Child, a program about science, religion, and the fantastic, including a chat with one of the writers of Doctor Who. But first, last week we proved either a little prescient or a little premature in discussing Pope Francis and the future of the Church. This week the Pope released his first major statement, Evangelii Gaudium, in which the National Catholic Reporter in the USA ventured to hail as Pope Francis' I Have a Dream speech. Well, to provide perhaps a little more sober reflection, Father Frank Brennan is back with us. Frank joined us last week to discuss Pope Francis and the way things were going. Frank Brennan, thanks for joining us once again.
Good evening, John. Good to be with you.
Are the signs and of expectations being fulfilled?
I think they are. I wouldn't draw such a parallel with the I Have a Dream speech, if only because this one's 50,000 words long, and there is a bit of Vaticanese in there, I have to confess. But I think we do get a sense of the real dream of Francis. As many of your listeners would know, papal documents of this sort, they usually end with a prayer to Mary, and he's got a wonderful little line in there where he says to Mary, "Help us to bear radiant witness to communion, service, ardent and generous faith, justice and love of the poor, that the joy of the gospel may reach to the ends of the earth, illuminating even the fringes of our world." Well, that's good news for everybody, and I think that's what he's been about.
It's an optimistic rather than a doleful cast.
It is. He's making it clear, you know, he's not going to do too much about changing a lot of church teachings immediately, as we were discussing last week. But in terms of just being engaged out there in the world and telling people to get off their backsides and not just be in church buildings, but to be out there in the world and doing something, particularly engaging with the poor and questions of justice, he says that's non-negotiable.
Well, you've touched on one of the issues there, social justice, that's front and centre. The two other things, of course, which were in the back of people's minds, firstly, on cleaning up the church, cleaning up the Vatican in particular, his word, a leprosy. Is there any indication of a way forward there?
There's not too much there, although there is a major theme, John, in terms of calling for decentralisation and saying that, look, people shouldn't be looking to the Vatican to provide answers on everything. There are local churches, there are local bishops' conferences, and he's even saying that local bishops' conferences have a role to play in discernment and in teaching. So we're getting away from this idea that your listeners will recall, you know, a bishop like Billy Morris in Toowoomba runs into a bit of trouble because people write anonymous letters to Rome and dicasteries over there do things and then send a visitor out from the United States. All that sort of thing's gone. In terms of getting engaged with local communities, he's saying that it's up to local churches to do things. But there's nothing in there which gives us any indication as to how he's going to actually clean up the Vatican mess.
Decentralisation as a theme, though, for those who are in the know, takes you right back to the mid-19th century and Lord Acton's famous aphorism.
Indeed.
All power corrupts.
And he's very aware that absolute power does corrupt, and he's very much taking to heart the notion of subsidiarity. One of the really heartening things about this document, John, is that he quotes at some length the synods of various locations, including the bishops of Oceania, who, for example, said, well, look, we've got to make sure we've got a more indigenous church, a church which was more sensitive to local cultures. And, of course, because he's a pope who's come from outside of Europe, he's made it very clear that the church is not Europe and Europe is not the church, and that basically local cultures have to count for much more.
And, of course, 20 years ago, people like Father Tisabella Soria were castigated for holding such views.
they were. I think at this stage he'd probably be welcomed. Who knows? He might even be made a cardinal if he was still alive.
Women. You were making some optimistic noises last week.
Well, fortunately, I got in and made my optimistic noises before this statement came out. It is the one big disappointment where he basically goes on to say that it's a question which is not open to discussion. And with all respect to the Holy Father, and I do think this is a great pope, but he basically says, well, that's not a question open for discussion, but don't worry, ladies, because we'll be able to separate out sacramental power from other power. Well, with all respect to him, I don't think that quite works, because if you're saying a question's not open for discussion, that's not an exercise of sacramental power. That's an exercise of power to determine theological issues and power to determine canonical questions, including sanctions, about what you can do within the life of the church. Now, if he wants to distinguish sacramental power from other power, John, I think he has to ensure that women have a place at the table, both with the theological power and the canonical power. And if we had women at the table saying that it should be a question not open for discussion, maybe we'd all be more readily convinced. So I think on this one he's squibbed it a bit, and I think it'll be an ongoing thorn in his side.
More to be said. The other one, Tom Roberts last week made an interesting observation when speaking of what's called the new evangelization. Can anybody tell me what that means, was Tom Roberts' observation. And the Pope does seem to have gone some way in giving at least a shape to it, if not a definition.
I think he does, and what he's done is say, look, what it's about is being able to engage in the world and to be appealing to young people. There's got to be a job for the church to do in terms of engaging with people who are wrestling with issues of poverty and of suffering, and there's got to be a sense that the liturgical life of the church reflects the lived experience of people.
So it's not it's not just souls in the heavenly lifeboat.
Definitely not, and that in the sacramental of the life of the church here and now, he says literally, let's throw the doors open. The idea that we exclude people, he says, is not on, that the Eucharist is not for the perfect, the Eucharist is medicine for all of us who are sinners. He's not going to discriminate amongst sinners. He's going to say, look, the sacramental life of the church is absolutely central for everybody and we should welcome them to the table.
One final question. How does this play out and resonate through the corridors of Catholic Christendom? Who needs to take notice?
We all need to take notice, particularly as he has some very strong remarks to make about the needs for structural economic change in the world. I mean, let's not forget that this is a cardinal who came from Buenos Aires, who lived among the poor, and who is adamant that the neoliberal economic agenda is bad news and is contrary to the gospel. So he's saying that this is a message which has to resonate loud and clear in every conceivable corridor throughout the globe.
Father Frank Brennan, Jesuit priest, lawyer, and professor at the Australian Catholic University in the ACT. Frank, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure, John. Good to be with you.
Father Frank Brennan on Sunday Nights. Well, last week was quite an anniversary for sci-fi fans. Not only did the master of this theme, Doctor Who, turn 50, though given his constitution I'm not quite sure what that means, but his anniversary coincided with the 50th anniversary of the death of two of the great contributors to the twin poles of sci-fi, the utopian and the dystopian, in the works of C.S. Lewis and Aldous Huxley. But if you are really in the know, just a few weeks before marked the anniversary of one of the great moments in science fiction history with a broadcast on October the 30th, 1938, of Orson Welles' radio production of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, a night that brought a nation to its knees. And aside from one or two forays, such as Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the 20th century can call the genre its own. In literature, it takes off in the late 19th century with Jules Verne and then H.G. Wells. But soon, the new technology of film made the future, good for good or ill, a virtual reality. From Star Wars to Star Child, lurking behind the triumph of physics, have been the nagging questions of metaphysics. The what's it all about moments that allow for philosophical reflection and even religious epiphany. The most recent, Gravity, still showing in our cinemas, a film to be seen only in 3D, finds transcendence in a teardrop and rebirth in a fall to earth. The big questions: what is life? What is morality? Can humanity survive? What lies ahead? Is there purpose in the universe? Each generation uses the canvas provided by sci-fi to ask those questions in its own way. So tonight, in tribute to the great Doctor and to all who have gone before, science, religion and fantasy. And it's a great pleasure to welcome our guests on the phone from New York, Robert Garaci, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan College, James McGrath, Butler University Professor of Religion and editor of a new book, Relative Dimensions in Faith, Religion and Doctor Who, and in our Melbourne TARDIS, the Reverend Dr. Avril Hannah-Jones of the Uniting Church. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Garaci, is science fiction asking questions that are fundamentally religious?
Absolutely. I mean, part of the magic of, well, I probably shouldn't use that word, but the magic of science fiction is that you have an infinite number of possibilities to engage, that big what-if question, and as soon as you put yourself in that situation, anything that's important to humanity will come up, whether it's the existence of God even, to what does it mean to be a human being, to, you know, what are our prospects for the future. All of that is, you know, sort of within the religious tradition.
James McGrath at Butler University, as editor of the book Relative Dimensions in Faith, Religion and Doctor Who, how does religion become explicit, or is it just an implicit thing with projects like Doctor Who?
Oh, I think it's most definitely explicit, and I don't think Robert should have apologized for using the word magic. Doctor Who is a great example of the fact that the lines between myth, fantasy, science fiction are extremely blurry. And so there's something really natural about raising some of these questions. And what science fiction does distinctively is to raise the same questions that myth and religious storytelling have always done, but to do so against the backdrop of what is at least claimed to be a scientific worldview. But of course, sometimes this so-called science doesn't have to be plausible, just has to be fun and allow us to explore things with our imagination. And all throughout the show's history, it has, you know, taken human beings who accompanied the Doctor back to key moments in history when religion has often been an important part of that. It has led them to encounters with powerful beings who, in another era at least, would have been called gods. And oftentimes that's quite explicit. There are certainly interesting implicit themes as well, but at times quite explicit.
Now, I'll bring in the Reverend Dr. Avril Hannah-Jones, a practicing Uniting Church minister in Melbourne. Avril, you're somebody who's interested in both science fiction and the broader extremes of the genre into fantasy. And, of course, in this arena, we can't overlook the link between people like C.S. Lewis, who not only wrote the Narnia Chronicles, but also engaged in some fantasy as some science fiction writing with his trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet trilogy, and J.R.R. Tolkien, friends in the Inklings, in that university combine, who both sort of walked around the edges of science fiction and fantasy to achieve wider purposes, almost didactic religious purposes.
Yes, but I think in quite different ways. C.S. Lewis was very much deliberately looking at the way in which a Christian narrative could be retold in another world. And Tolkien found that quite, you know, inauthentic. He wanted to really create a truthful myth rather than grabbing bits and pieces from other cultures in the way that Lewis did. But I think for both of them, what they saw themselves as doing was recreating in imitation of God the Creator. And Tolkien wrote that quite specifically in one of his long poems, that we make by the law by which we're made. So for them, there was an intrinsic link between their faith and what they were doing when they were writing.
Because, Robert Geraci, this idea of the truthful myth underlines Lucas's Star Wars trilogy, Star Wars episodes as well, in that he's drawing on Joseph Campbell, quite explicitly says he drew on Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in picking up what Avril just pointed out, Tolkien in his own writings also speaks about world creation through myth, and Lucas has spoken at length about, or had, you know, in a number of interviews, about the importance of creating a modern myth, a myth that would work for today's youth, you know, and so that idea that you could create something that was fundamentally true and fundamentally full of meaning for the watcher or the reader or the listener or so forth is an opportunity to create a kind of religious tale that's not married necessarily to the facts of whether something, quote, really happened or didn't.
And, of course, that world creation thing is trackable through much of modern science fiction, whether you go to Asimov and the Foundation series or Frank Herbert and his Dune series. You are dealing with worlds and the moral compass of those worlds. Robert Geraci.
I think this ability to imitate the gods and create is one of our most cherished capacities. And in something like science fiction or fantasy literature, you get as much creative power as you're ever going to get in the world, because it's the power to make a new world. And so it runs rampant through the sort of literary efforts of our authors today.
James McGrath, could you identify that as one of the significant arcs of sci-fi, this ability to create a world and ask the sort of metaphysical questions out of the creations of the physics of the new world? It's a way of being able to ask questions that about transcendence that you're not allowed to ask today in conventional life.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that we've ever quite reached the stage where we're not allowed to ask those questions, although...
Well, it's sort of out of fashion.
There are some rules about what's, you know, polite for certain kinds of dinner conversations, of course. But certainly I think there's something natural about those questions coming up and being asked in science fiction. There are theories, if we can call them that, some of them haven't really reached that level yet, but about how we account for the fact that our universe has the facets that it does, has us within it, and there have been scientists who've explored ideas such as parallel universes, multiple universes, and of course those things are classic elements of science fiction as well. And really, with the possibility of infinite universes, you have limitless possibilities. You can have, you know, if infinity is real, then there presumably by definition must be a universe where a god such as the Bible depicts exists, and there must be a universe where there are no gods. And so there's a sense in which every possibility can be explored and can at least intersect with some ideas that even scientists are exploring. And so science fiction really does bring us naturally into those metaphysical questions.
Avril, science fiction really has masters as straddles two great areas. You've got literature and film, and you can't actually talk about science fiction without talking about both genre, and by film I'm including television as well, because it has reached some of its greatest heights in the imagery that's constructed, in the way you're able to realise almost the transcendent through the reconstruction of new worlds. You take, again, Frank Herbert's Dune, or you take most recently the 3D experience of Gravity, and the visceral, the psychic, becomes very, very powerful as again, a way that the technology is tapping the transcendent.
Absolutely. It's fascinating the way we can now experience the contents of someone else's imagination so clearly and so closely in a way that I think for many younger people makes that much more real to them and much more believable than anything I could try and talk to them about when I'm, you know, in my church doing my day job. They provide opportunities for us to explore things in a level of detail that would have been literally unimaginable, you know, 50 years ago when Lewis died and Huxley died and the Doctor appeared, as you can see by looking at, you know, early episodes of Doctor Who.
Is it something that you're able to use in church in a way that, strangely, grounds what are older fables in a new reality?
I try to. I think one of the advantages of sci-fi and fantasy is that they're genres in which people can talk about good and evil unapologetically. You can actually Right. consider questions of what is good and what is evil, and there aren't too many places in the modern world where you can do that. And discussing that at a level of, you know, Harry Potter for young people, I mean, obviously Star Wars for anyone born in the 70s like myself, they raise questions of what does it mean to be good and bad? What does it mean to have the light side and the dark side of the Force? And that then is able to be drawn into the questions that religions ask about what are good and evil? What does that mean?
Robert Geraci, the philosophical dimensions of this are thrown up particularly in one genre, subgenre of science fiction, and that's the genre, that, one of the ones that you're interested in particularly, and that's artificial intelligence. Most people would immediately recall that chilling scene out of 2001 where Hal responds to Dave Bowman. That is one of the great moments of 20th century art, let alone a genre called sci-fi.
It is. It's also had perhaps not always the effects that one might have wanted. You know, we have 100 years approximately, you know, very nearly worth of conversation about specifically these technological robots. I mean, you can go back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but... more recently, robots and artificial intelligence in a clearer, more contemporary fashion, and they're always sort of there to throw into relief what is human. And in 2001, we have this terrible moment where we're trying to figure out, you know, the kind of the value of the human and the choices being made. And in some sense, since Hal is suffering from an error, he's kind of deeply human, or it is kind of deeply human, you know, in that it's then going to preserve, it wants to preserve its life, it will kill to maintain its assumptions about reality. And so many people have looked at that and then just been scared of the machine, when it's plausible we really ought to be much more scared of ourselves than the machines we're looking at in those kinds of scenarios. If nothing else, we're the ones who made them. Go ahead.
No. I just want to just extend that a little with the way in which AI, artificial intelligence, the name of the movie, AI, is used to create, to set up the great moral questions, or some of the great moral questions. Blade Runner is perhaps one of the best examples too.
Yeah, and Blade Runner is brilliant in those moments where it really challenges us to ask, who's the murderer here? Are we as culpable as the machines? Where's the role of empathy in all this, which of course is probably the running theme. If you had to pick one theme that runs throughout Philip K. Dick's novels, it's this question of empathy and what it means to feel for another. And for Dick, the machines could feel and become human, and humans could cease to feel and become machines. And we see that in Blade Runner when, in the end, you know, the replicant actually saves Deckard, who would have died, and shows that actually he can, you know, he can actually care for others and be thoughtful of others, even in his own death, right? And so it is an opportunity for us to think about what really matters as human beings. And, of course, what kind of great art doesn't do that.
Avril, where do you find the resources? What do you draw on if you're talking to a congregation and using the imagery of science fiction and fantasy? Are you taking out particular stories, that is, this story is equivalent to that, or are you looking at the way in which some of these things take us on a great archetypical journey?
Not any sort of equivalence. I don't think that would be honest to either my faith or to the stories. But definitely themes and underlying questions. I think what both religion and sci-fi do very well is ask questions, and often they're asking the same questions. It's not so much that either of them are providing particular answers, but they're opening avenues for exploration and ways that we can look at things. But then recently, there's been a whole lot of work in which it's ultimately come down to the question of self-sacrifice and love. And so it's very hard not to, you know, talk about Harry Potter to kids and not end up with the whole sacrificing yourself for your friends out of love, resurrection type thing, because J.K. Rowling deliberately wrote it in the last book.
And I guess movies like The Matrix, again, raise those questions as well.
Yeah, I struggled a wee bit with The Matrix because it just felt so obvious. I mean, when you've got a character called Trinity roaming around, it really felt like I was being clobbered over the head with, you know, deep religious themes in this movie.
James McGrath, have you seen Gravity yet?
I haven't seen Gravity yet.
See, Robert, have you seen Gravity yet?
I'm just as useless. I'm sorry.
Look, okay, we're going to have to save that conversation some other time. Let me go back and take the other great cinematic example of sci-fi, and that's Kubrick's 2001. Here is a film that is not in... It breaks almost every rule. It's not a simple narrative. You have to almost follow it as a symphony in three movements musically. Your aesthetic sensibility is music as you're watching it. Yet at the beginning, you have the great black obelisk, the question why. At the end, you have the Star Child in some sort of, well, perhaps allusion to a resolution. How important a movie is Kubrick's 2001 in bringing science and science fiction into a conversation with the metaphysical? Robert.
Well, it's enormously important and across a huge number of areas, because it's also influential to, say, scientists who read Clark or saw Clark and then changed what might have been their career paths on the way, as they both saw technologies that were fascinating and philosophical questions that were intriguing and that were perhaps engageable in ways that it hadn't occurred to them before then. And in kind of the contemporary legacy includes a number of people in what we call the transhumanist community, those who believe that through science and technology we can transcend the human condition, our present weaknesses, mortality and disease and so forth, and who still find that text to be and film to be inspiring because of that amazing shift of evolution that the film follows, right? When you start with the, pre-evolved people and the obelisk, and then you move all the way to this transcendent creature at the end who can stop war, you know, stop nuclear weapons, and it has magical powers of whatever nature. This evolution toward cosmic consciousness, which was itself influenced by the Jesuit philosopher Teilhard de Chardin, that process of evolution is one that people are still looking back on and reflecting as being, you know, Clark was a kind of prophet in his work, and Kubrick also in his collaboration there. And so the film has been extraordinarily important, and a lot of the scientists who have grounded this idea that, hey, we can use science to do this stuff that people used to look to religion for, they themselves were influenced by Clark to become the kinds of scientists they are.
James McGrath, this question of the literature making an important contribution. Science fiction has begun to emerge as literature and as great art. It's no longer considered the sort of corner for nerds. What would you mark as the great ones for you?
Oh, gosh, I'm not sure that I could narrow down the list sufficiently to fit within the time allotted to us today.
Give me your top three.
But there certainly
well,
are...
Well, three books, three movies.
Three books, three movies. Let's see. And I'm not sure that there'll be the three books first and then the three movies. Star Wars, the original trilogy, I'm not sure whether that counts as my three movies all being used up at once. But,
that's only one movie.
Okay, fine. Then... But it certainly has something, you know, particularly special about it. I mean, it starts, as has already been mentioned, with the archetypal narrative of, you know, the sort of farm boy who dreams of adventure, meets a wise old wizard who mediates that experience to him, rescues a princess, engages in acts of heroism, and fairly standard fare there. And then what the original trilogy went on to do was to complicate those things. And to suggest that, you know, simply seeking excitement and desiring adventure were not enough to actually really make a difference and to combat evil. And by the end of the film, where some of the wiser old guard want Luke Skywalker to kill his father and defeat evil in that way, he actually does something which, you know, from one perspective at least, is better. He redeems his father. He finds the good still within him and brings him back from that dark place that he's gotten to, rather than overcoming him by killing him. And so there's actually something quite profound, morally and spiritually, in the Star Wars films. And so certainly that would be an important one.
All right, we'll give you a three in one there, and I'll now go to Avril. Just nominate one, Avril, if you want to.
Oh, I was sitting here thinking of six. I have to quickly
give us
say.
Give a quick summary.
Okay, as a child of the 70s, Star Wars was obviously important for me, but if I can only have one, it's got to be Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, which is world-constructing. Robert Geraci, what would you nominate? I'll give you two.
Does it need... Can I pick a book?
Yeah, you can pick a book and a movie.
A book and a movie. All right. At the risk of being the least original person here, I'm going with... Star Wars in the world of film, but I don't know how much of that is the sheer genius of the Star Wars trilogy and how much of it is that I, you know, was born and raised on that trilogy, you know, that it was so influential in my life in that way. But also I think it's important in that it continues to reshape culture, both in terms of these new films coming out, but the video game, the online world, Star Wars The New Republic, where, you know, you get a number of people actually participating in the Star Wars universe. They get to be Jedis, you know, the thing that they had wanted for the last several decades. They now get to be Jedis. And I would, you know, I just can't help but tout the book by Neal Stephenson, the book Snow Crash, which is not only one of the most masterful science fiction books ever written, but also does a wonderful job of integrating a set of religious ideas into this narrative about computers and virtual worlds. And it's just a stunning, stunning book.
There's a new one for some. Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Now, we're going to pause for a moment. And this is for a moment of extraordinary daring. It's from an episode of Doctor Who called Gridlock, an episode that visually echoes sci-fi history from early talkies like Just Imagine through to the Jetsons and even Blade Runner. Yet in the middle, it dares to touch the ties that bind.
I think you know us so well, Doctor. We're not abandoned, not while we have each other.
This is for all of you out there on the roads. We're so sorry. Drive safe.
Oh.
There wasn't a dry eye in front of the television screen. From Doctor Who, the episode Gridlock. And it's a great pleasure to welcome another voice on the TARDIS telephone, the Reverend Carolyn Simcox, an Anglican vicar, but also an occasional writer for the Doctor Who series. Carolyn, good to have you with us.
Having me.
Carolyn, that was an extraordinary piece of writing, and also remarkably cheeky, that in the midst of our angst, we reached for religare, the ties that bind.
Mm. Yes, it's an amazing example, isn't it? It's where you actually see grace conveyed in the Doctor Who universe. It's interesting in that the episode, that him appearing is actually without context. It appears suddenly. It's as if the writer, Russell T. Davis, as if he was wanting to convey the old Marxist idea of religion being the opiate of the masses. It's what kept the people quiet as they circled around in this gridlocked planet. But when it actually appears on screen, there wasn't a dry eye on screen either. It was just an amazing moment of light breaking through. There really is no other way to talk about it.
Was that a deliberate well, you've given us some of the intention of Russell T. Davies in that. And Stephen Moffat and Russell T. Davies, the two people most associated with Doctor Who in its present incarnation, from your conversations, they're dealing with sort of metaphysical, almost transcendent issues, occasionally quite deliberately, and even sometimes the arc of the story takes us in that direction.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I think over the years, I mean, Doctor Who, of course, has been going for 50 years, which is a very long time, and a period of time in which there have been seismic changes in people's attitude to religion and to theology. I think in the early days, of course, of Doctor Who, it was pretty much a hands-off approach to Christianity and religious themes in general. But these days, now that we're living in a rather more postmodern world, people feel a lot more free to be able to address those wider questions of ultimate significance and of eternity and redemption and all those wonderful big themes. And Doctor Who isn't holding back, which is a wonderful thing. It's prompted so many great conversations and so many great sermons from colleagues. I've not done it yet. I've not actually preached Doctor Who, but it does happen, I'm told.
James McGrath at Butler University, as a professor of religion and editor of a new book, Relative Dimensions in Faith, Religion and Doctor Who, there must be a question or two you're just begging to ask Carolyn.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. I'm a huge fan of the audiobook that Carolyn wrote, Doctor Who and the Council of Nicaea.
Thank you.
I think it's just an amazing seizing of an opportunity that Doctor Who provides, which is to take the Doctor and some representatives of our own perspective in the future from the perspective of those events and put them back in the midst of a very different time in history, one that we think we're familiar with, but of course, which, you know, without some fleshing out in a fictional sort of way, it's impossible to explore in as much detail as we'd like and really get a sense of. And so bringing these characters, which include, you know, sort of a modern person but also an ancient Egyptian, and giving these different perspectives on what the events as they were unfolding there was just fascinating. I guess the question would be, why that particular event in history? What led you to focus on that one and explore it the way that you did?
Well, it's because I studied theology at undergraduate level, and patristics, which is, of course, the period that deals with the early church, I always found very interesting but very dry. There was lots of, usually the reports that you get about the Council of Nicaea is these vast doctrinal conversations which sound extremely dusty and hard to swallow. But I was lucky enough to go to lectures by a chap called Dr. Edwards, who brought it to life, who actually explained about how these conversations were affecting everybody's lives. People on the street were getting involved at these extremely high-level discussions, were actually changing how they lived, and there were riots on the streets and people being lynched, and everybody was involved, and it just brought it to life for me. And I thought, you know, I would love to see this era, this absolutely pivotal moment in the church's history brought to life in that way, and I thought Doctor Who would be a perfect way to do it. And I was very lucky that Gary Russell, the producer of Big Finish at that time, and my director on that play, was able to give me that chance. I suspect that these days we wouldn't be able to do quite such a blatantly religious themed audio play these days, now that the new series has started, but then it was absolutely perfect.
Carolyn, what's been your closest involvement with the series and the one that's most rewarding for you?
My closest involvement? It probably is writing those Big Finish series. I mean, I've been a Doctor Who fan from the ground up. I was a child of the Sylvester McCoy era, so I was watching Doctor Who back then, and I've been a fan ever since. I was president of the Oxford University Doctor Who Society. But actually being able to write the words Doctor in a script and have him speak, and I was lucky enough to write for two Doctors, for the Eighth Doctor, who's Paul McGann, in an audio play that I co-wrote with my husband Paul Cornell called Seasons of Fear, and to write for Peter Davison in the Council of Nicaea. And actually being involved with writing the Doctor was, yeah, an absolutely key moment for me in my involvement with the series.
Avril Hannah-Jones, as a fellow member of the Cloth.
Yes.
What would you like, or what would you request of Carolyn?
Well, if she had any influence to, you know, good people of the Cloth as characters, because sci-fi is sadly lacking them. No, what I'd be really interested in is your reflection on New Who has quite a lot of religious themes in it, but I'm not sure they're positive. I mean, even that idea of gridlock, as you say, Russell T. Davies did seem to be going with the opiate of the masses reference.
I do believe that was his slant. But there are wonderfully positive examples as well. I'm going to point you to the first season of the new series, the Christopher Eccleston, the Ninth Doctor, and mm-hmm. the episode being Father's Day. In which we see an example of what I would think of as Carl Rahner's transcendent grace, which is the fact that the sacrifice of the character, I hope I'm not spoiling for anyone, but the sacrifice of himself by Rose's father actually changes the world, changes the universe for the better. Mm. And it's not remarked upon, but it's a marvelous example of grace at work, that this moment of transcendent self-giving actually changes the world around.
Absolutely. I think when Doctor Who isn't specifically addressing faith as such, it does it amazingly. But every so often, particularly in Russell T. Davies' era, they will talk about faith, and it seems fairly clear that as far as Davies is concerned, the only good faith humans can have is actually in the Doctor. Any other sort of faith is going to lead them into trouble. I think it's when they're not talking about issues of faith and religion that the series does it beautifully.
Mm. Well, you're right, of course. I do think I believe he would describe himself as a humanist. I hope I'm not putting words into Russell's mouth. But there is certainly, and you'll find it all the way through Doctor Who, actually, all the way back through the 50 years, the idea of faith being a concept about faith in the Doctor or faith in each other. It's kind of a much more anthropologically centered idea of faith. And I think it would be nice to see faith in a higher being presented in a much more positive way. I was a bit disappointed by, there was an episode written quite recently, and the name of it's escaping me, how embarrassing.
The God Complex? The God Complex?
The God Complex, yes, yep. Of course, Toby Whithouse.
Yes, destroyed my life.
Oh, really? But it was quite a negative idea of faith. And I came away from that feeling a little bit rocked back. But I think Doctor Who can and hopefully will do better in terms of presenting faith as not a negative concept.
Robert Geraci, any observations for Carolyn?
Yeah, you know, so much of what is at stake in science fiction as a genre is as a mythical genre, as a place where that meaning is located. And in that respect, it often comes out as in competition with traditional myths. And I'm using the word myth in a technical sense, not in a that stuff that's not true that other people believe sense, right? But so you get, even among many, many fans of the genre, you can see, for example, Bill Bainbridge, the sociologist, did a study some decades ago about what kinds of literatures that science fiction readers enjoy, for example. And the only thing they liked less than the Bible was occult literature. You know, so they're, what you tended to have is people who perhaps become really profoundly interested in science fiction, and this, of course, it's not everybody, but many in the community, because perhaps they're disaffected from traditional sources of myth. And once one has become disaffected, that perhaps explains why so often in science fiction you have either neutral or negative portrayals of traditional faiths, because the people who are writing and quite frequently watching are themselves alienated from those traditional faiths. And obviously that's not universally true, and C.S. Lewis, as we discussed in the beginning, is a perfect example of someone who could wed those two forms of literature, the theological and science fiction. But for many, I think they do exist as kind of parallel forms of meaning making. And if for many people, if they've chosen one route, the other route doesn't look open to them.
It's a very interesting concept. It's easy to trace the often you'll find science fiction fans and science fiction writers who are disaffected with religion. I'm not sure it's cause and effect. I think that science fiction tends to attract outsiders of all stripes, and that will gather in people who are disaffected with traditional religious structures as well.
I'm not sure, Carolyn, whether Doctor Who, maybe according to the writer, but certainly over the last decade, is dystopian or utopian. It seems to wander between the two. So you get a series of episodes which take you into what seems like a very dark, dark future, and others in which it's all, possibly light on the hill stuff.
Yes, that's the nature of the program, of course, that it feels free to go where it wants. But, of course, that does give it tremendous freedom to address different themes in different contexts. It's that which is most valuable about all science fiction, I think, that it gives scope to use a typological or an allegorical landscape to explore questions which might not be possible to explore in a more modern-day setting, for example.
Carolyn, we're going to have to let you go in a moment, but just one comment from me that I'll get you to make an observation on. It seems to me that the religious questions are built into the very fabric of the program. It seems to me that Doctor Who himself, by his nature, an immortal who can travel through time and, if needed, only after great pleading from mortals or through his own capricious will, intervene and break the laws of the universe to affect a moral outcome, is a god. Surely by any conventional definition, a god, and even more precisely, as a Time Lord, an exiled member of a quarrelsome elite, one of an archetype, the gods of Olympus. Doctor Who, having left the quarrels of Olympus, is a god wandering among mere mortals.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair idea, that he is kind of a Prometheus figure, bringing enlightenment with him. Of course, the one thing that separates him from godlike, although you could argue that the gods of Olympus don't possess this attribute, is his lack of knowledge. He knows a lot, but he's definitely limited in terms of what he knows, and he does get things wrong. So, of course, you do have that difference. But I think the likening him to the Greek gods is probably quite accurate, yes.
Carolyn, are there any little secrets you can let out of the box for us?
No, I can't tell you anything. Dear, oh dear. I would be in big trouble if I had anything to tell, which of course I don't.
You won't play Pandora for us.
I won't, I'm sorry.
Carolyn Simcox, thanks so much for joining us and disturbing your Sunday for us.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure.
Wonderful to have you with us. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. We've got 5 minutes. We'll take a couple of calls from listeners. 1-300-800-222. Barry is on the line from Mount Isa. And Barry, a chance for you to ask a question or make a comment. Barry from Mount Isa. Hi, Barry.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good.
I'd just like to say I'll be 46 next year, and I've watched science fiction all my life. I grew up on Doctor Who and Star Trek and Blake 7 and Battlestar Galactica. I wouldn't classify myself as a religious or spiritual person. I'd probably describe myself as a Darwinian evolutionist, a rational existentialist, and a secular humanist. Sometimes when I was growing up, things weren't always easy and easy to get along in life and whatever. And I always found science fiction very interesting and engaging, and I got great solace and comfort from it.
What was it about science fiction that did it for you?
It was the stories. It was the sort of the ethical, moral bent to a lot of the shows and things like that. And there were times when I needed that episode once a week or whatever just to get me through, just something to hold on to and look forward to. But this is just a thought. I mean, in relation to the origins of, say, religion or whatever, one could always use this sort of thought that were the aliens angels or were the angels aliens?
Thank you. There's a script for Doctor Who, although it may have been used. So time for some final comments. Robert Caracci, the arc of science fiction, as I began to say before we spoke to Carolyn, science fiction itself has now reached the status of serious literature. I guess it began with Huxley and Wells. But as a serious art form, the future, the big questions continue to be asked, a fertile form for the future?
I think absolutely. I mean, the more we get invested in new ways of storytelling and technology is doing that for us all the time, the more we'll continue to explore them through this particular genre, especially because even in its dystopian form, science fiction tends to be a genre of hope and optimism. I mean, the point of a dystopian text is to tell us what to avoid, not to tell us what will be the case. And then you have more utopian offerings that give us something to look forward to. So I think that given that we as a species will always be trying to press and make our world a better one, not always doing a very good job of it, but trying to make our lives better, science fiction will remain a genre through which we imagine that and maybe even try to bring it about.
James McGrath of Butler University, and where can we get hold of your new book, Relative Dimensions in Faith, Religion, and Doctor Who?
Oh, well, you can find it via Amazon in the various countries. They actually switched around the title in the original UK version is Time and Relative Dimensions in Faith, and then the subtitle is Religion, Doctor Who. And for an American audience, they've actually switched those two around. I guess they thought that Time and Relative Dimensions in Faith wasn't as self-explanatory for an American audience as it is for a British one.
And Avril Hannah-Jones, you've got about 10 seconds to tell us where we can find you on Sundays if we want a sermon on science fiction and fantasy.
I'm the minister at Williamstown Uniting Church, but once a year we have what we call the Church of Latter-day Geeks. And so Google that and you'll find us having a sci-fi service once a year.
And here we finish with the glorious music of Strauss from 2001. Thank you all. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.